ॐ सदाशिवसमारम्भां शङ्कराचार्यमध्यमाम् अस्मदाचार्यपर्यन्तां वन्दे गुरुपरम्पराम्। ॐ सहनावतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यं करवावहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। I wanted to spend the next 3 weeks or so talking about this beautiful Prata Smarana Stotra. It's a stotra, often translated as hymn, but it's a metrical composition attributed to Adi Shankaracharya. Adi Shankaracharya was a luminary in this tradition. His name is Shankara, and Acharya means the teacher. Shankaracharya is the teacher whose name is Shankara. And he's famous because he lived an extraordinary life. He is said to have lived to only be 32 or 33. And he wrote definitive commentaries in Sanskrit on 10 of the Upanishads. There are 108 different Upanishads, which are part of the Veda. And he wrote commentaries on 10 of these. He wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita and a commentary on the Brahma Sutra. These three texts, these three groups of texts, the Upanishads, the Gita, and the Brahma Sutra, are called the Prasthanatraya, the three core texts which reveal and hold this teaching. And Shankara took the teaching that he had, he took the teaching of his teacher, and based on that wrote commentaries. And so the commentaries have different flavors, let's say. The Brahma Sutra is a Nyaya Grantha. It's a book of logic, and his commentaries are very lengthy, very detailed. And there's a lot of dialogue, Purva Paksha Siddhanta, where he'll introduce objections. He'll introduce objectors as if characters in this bhasha, in this commentary. And they'll have a dialogue about very subtle and philosophical and deep and sometimes very complex topics. And the Brahma Sutra needs a lot of explanation because being a sutra literature is very pithy, very short phrases. Like the second sutra of Yoga Sutra is Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga is the control of the thoughts of the mind, mastery over the changes of the mind. And it could take hours to explain what that is. So Shankara wrote the commentaries on 10 of the Upanishads, on the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutra. He also wrote a number of Prakarana Granthas. These Prakarana Granthas, Prakarana Grantha is a book which takes what is said in the Bhagavad Gita and primarily the Upanishads and restates it. So he wrote a book called Viveka Chudamani, The Crest Jewel of Discrimination, of some 700 or so verses. Upadesha Sahasri, 1,000 verses on the teaching. Upadesha means teaching. Sahasri means 1,000. He also wrote some shorter texts, and this is one of them. This is the entire teaching of the Advaita Vedanta in 3 verses. He also wrote a verse called Ekashloki, one verse, which is said to describe the entirety of Advaita. And if you notice, in the first chant I did was to Shankaracharya, to the entire parampara. The parampara is the lineage. Shankara didn't make this stuff up. He learned it from his teacher, Govindapada, who learned it from his teacher, Gaudapadacharya, who learned it from his teacher. And so there's this stream, this flow of the holy river of Ganga in the form of knowledge from teacher to student, teacher to student. So the first chant I did was Sadashiva Samadharam Bham Shankaracharya Madhyamam Asmadacharya Paryantam Vande Guru Paramparam. I honor this Guru Parampara, this teacher-student lineage, whose beginning is the Lord himself, whose middle link is Shankaracharya, whose latest link, most recent, is my own teacher, Asmat Acharya Paryantam, up to even my own teacher. So it's considered an unbroken teaching tradition, this vision of freedom and joy. And so this is a very common chant we do at the beginning of class to honor this whole parampara, this whole lineage. And he's called Adi Shankaracharya because he's the first Shankaracharya. So he established four mutts, four centers of learning. And each of these has a head, a leader, and that leader is called Shankaracharya. He's given the name Shankaracharya. So sometimes some texts are said to be written by Shankaracharya. And perhaps some of these texts were written by one of the other Shankaracharyas, because Adi Shankaracharya lived in the 8th century. And since then, there have been at least, I don't know how many, dozens, hundreds of individuals, scholars and saints who've been referred to as Shankaracharya. But Adi Shankaracharya is also called Bhashyakara, because he's the one who wrote the Bhashyas. He's the one who wrote the commentaries. And in this text called Pratasmaranam Stotram, it's a stotra which is a remembrance, a meditation in the morning. Prataha, pratar, means dawn. Smarana means memory or contemplation. And so I wanted to go through this text. We can practice chanting it at the beginning here, and then we can go into the meaning. It's a beautiful hymn to chant in the morning. It brings the entire teaching of Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, to mind, and it's meant as a morning hymn. So it goes, Pratasmarami hridi samspuradatma tattvam Satchit sukham paramaham sagatim turiyam Yat svapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam Tad brahma nishkalamahannacha bhuta sangaha. Now that can be quite a mouthful, right? So what I'll do, I'll just repeat it eighth by eighth. So I'll repeat two or three words, and then you can repeat them. Well, you repeat them once after me. And we'll go through that whole thing, through the whole first verse, and then we'll try to chant it all together very slowly. And it might take some time to learn it. Ideally, we would memorize this. It's a very beautiful hymn. So repeat it along with me the second time. And the melody is not an intrinsic part of a stotra. It is metrical. It's in verse form, but the melody can change. And I wouldn't be surprised if I chanted in a different melody from one day to the next. But this is what I'm doing now. So you can create your own melody for it. Because it's classical Sanskrit. It's not Vedic Sanskrit. So Vedic Sanskrit has the swaras, the notes, as an integral part of the language. Whereas classical Sanskrit has no swaras, has no embedded intonation. And so you're free to put any melody that you like with these hymns, along with, say, the Bhagavad Gita. You can use any melody to sing this. Pratasmarami hridi. Pratasmarami hridi. Samspuradatma tattvam. Samspuradatma tattvam. The whole line. Pratasmarami hridi. Samspuradatma tattvam. Again. Pratasmarami hridi samspurat atma tattvam. Listen. Sachit sukham. Together. Sachit sukham. Listen. Paramahamsa gatin turiyam. Together. Paramahamsa gatin turiyam. The whole line together. Sachit sukham paramahamsa gatin turiyam. Again. Sachit sukham paramahamsa gatin turiyam. Listen. Yat swapna jagara sushuptam. Together. Yat swapna jagara sushuptam. Listen. Avaiti nityam. Together. Avaiti nityam. The whole line. Yat swapna na jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam. Again. Yat swapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam. Listen. Tad brahma nishkalam. Repeat. Tad brahma nishkalam. Ahanna cha bhuta sanghaha. Ahanna cha bhuta sanghaha. Last line together. Tad brahma nishkalam ahanna cha bhuta sanghaha. Again. Tad brahma nishkalam ahanna cha bhuta sanghaha. Let's try it one time all together. Pratasmarami hridi samspuradatma tattvam. Sachit sukham paramahamsa gatin turiyam. Yat swapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nit. Tyam tad brahma nishkalam ahanna cha bhuta sanghaha. So there is a literature in this tradition called Suprabhatam. Suprabhatam, prabha means to shine. Prabhatam means shining. It means the morning when the sun rises, it shines. Suprabhatam means good morning, literally. And so there's this group of hymns. One of the most famous is Venkateshwara Suprabhatam. Tava Suprabhatam. For you, Tava, may there be a good morning. So in fact, it's sort of like the Lord's wake-up call. Devotees are the Lord's alarm clock because you go to the temple traditionally early in the morning, 4:30 or so. You do a little Ganesha Puja, and then you start a Suprabhatam oftentimes. And you're saying, wake up, Lord. And the pujari is then taking off the clothes of the murti and then bathing it and doing abhishekam and doing the whole puja. So there's this beautiful tradition of early morning songs. Some are called suprabhatams, which is a beautiful rendition of a suprabhatam by Subbu Lakshmi. Very nice. Probably on YouTube. This is a pratar smaranam, prataha. Pratar means in the morning, at dawn. You can think about this as an invitation for our own awakening. What does it mean if we sit in front of the Lord and ask him to awaken? It's really an invitation to ourselves to awaken. Not from the slumber of last night, but to awaken to the truth of ourselves. Pratar smarami, I meditate in the morning, at dawn. You'll come across hymns to Ganesha, you'll come across a version of a hymn to Shiva, where you are extolling Shiva, the form of the Lord, as the form of Shiva, or the form of the Lord as Ganesha. And it'll talk about the subtle and playful and profound attributes of these particular deities. Beautiful practice. What Adi Shankaracharya did here in this morning hymn is to make it into a contemplation on oneself. Atma. Because most of the time, our meditations are on an atma, on the non-self, on something we objectify, on an object. Let's place our attention on the tip of our nose. Let's place our attention on a mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. Let's place our attention on visualizing a murti. Let's place the attention in parts of our body. And all of those are anatma. They're not me. I am the meditator, and I place my attention in order to help quiet my mind, create some chitta naishchalyam, some equanimity, some a non-agitated mind. Let me practice meditation on something to try to keep it in one place. The usefulness of that is not only do you over time attain a quietness and a contemplativeness, which is absolutely necessary for this teaching to really take root, you gain some say over what is in your mind and some say over what you do in your actions. You gain some dhamma, you gain some shama. It's all very beautiful. If it's a devotional meditation, such as an upasana, it's an act of devotion. It actually creates punyam for you. But here, we turn the tables on meditation. We turn the tables on meditation because we meditate upon the meditator. How can that be? How can we meditate upon the meditator? We'll see. And like I mentioned in the meditation today, you sort of have to back into it because I am not an object. I am not objectifiable, right? But I am the truth of objects, the experiences, and the subject. And because I'm the truth of the subject, there is room for me to appreciate my nature as the truth of the meditator. If I gain a quiet mind and then turn that quiet mind towards my very being, and I don't practice being, I have an intention and place my attention on just being, and I begin to rest in myself. And that is nididhyasana. I just rest in the most pleasant place possible in myself, which is satchidananda. So, this appreciation of myself early in the morning is a beautiful way to start the day. Sometimes it's difficult because we wake up very groggy. You know, if our sleeping habits are irregular, actually I just read a report saying that if your sleeping habits are irregular, there's actually an increased risk of serious health problems like diabetes and other health issues. If you bookend your sleep with a sattvaka buddhi, if you bookend your sleep with a quiet mind, if you go to sleep with a quiet, prayerful mind, if you sit for just a couple minutes, a few minutes before going to sleep, and you don't eat a heavy meal, you can learn to wake up feeling refreshed. And then the first thought at the beginning of the day can be something along the lines of this contemplation. Because there's nothing more joyful than just appreciating the quiet presence of my very being. And if I don't appreciate the quiet presence of my very being and rest joyfully in that knowledge, in that direct appreciation, then my life becomes a process of seeking transformation. My life becomes a process of trying to become. And that is samsara. And that process of trying to become, which is based on my non-appreciation of the true beauty of my very being, denies the joy of that being because I'm constantly trying to become. And it's putting my attention on the wrong place. It's putting my attention on what I need to gain, what new experience, what spackle I need to buy to cover up the holes I feel in my soul, because nothing seems to really complete me. Nothing I do completes me. Nothing I gain completes me. It may temporarily give me a jolly. That's fine. You know, tacos are good. But it doesn't, whatever I pursue doesn't really scratch the itch. It doesn't satisfy in the long run. So when I don't appreciate the simple beauty of myself, my very being, life becomes a process of seeking transformation, which denies the joy of my very being. And so Vedanta is the study of my being, of my human existence and my experience, and the study, the inquiry into my struggles to become, and my passions and my distractions. And some people take Advaita. I use Vedanta and Advaita synonymously here, although there are other notions about Vedanta which are dualistic or semi-dualistic in nature by later scholars. When we say Vedanta, we mean Advaita, non-dual, non-duality, the vision of non-duality. And it's when we say the Shastra, or we say Vedanta is a system, or we say that Vedanta is a philosophy, those last two statements are very misleading, because a system is not talking about me. A system tries to create a structure out of our experience. An ology, a philosophy, is something abstract and maybe a wonderful castle in the sky that we can appreciate, but what does it have to do with me? No, Vedanta Shastra, which is Advaita, is all about me. It's a very self-centered pursuit, because all it is talking about you. Because it says, as Pujaswamiji says, you are the problem and you are the solution. And so it studies the meanness. What is it I take myself to be? It inquires, koham, kaha aham, who am I? Who am I? What is my nature? What am I doing? Why do I react certain ways, etc.? So this pursuit of Advaita Vedanta is not an intellectual pursuit, although we use our minds. It's not a path of the heart, although our heart blossoms with quietude and joy in this teaching. Not an intellectual pursuit, although, you know, we use logic. But in the end, it's a vision. This parampara, this guru shishya parampara, this lineage between of student, teacher, student, teacher, student, teacher, holds what is called the sampradaya. Two words, parampara is the lineage, sampradaya is the teaching methodology. If a teacher's vision is the vision of the rishis of ancient India, which is expressed in the Upanishads, if a teacher's vision is synonymous with that, and the teacher sees that clearly for him or herself and is able to communicate that to a student, then that student's vision becomes the same as the guru's vision, which is the same as the Arsha Drishti, which is the same as the vision of the rishis, the sages of ancient India. And through the sampradaya, through the method of enfoldment, this vision is passed on generation after generation after generation. And it's utterly transformative by recognizing the utterly non-changing self. When you recognize that the self does not change, your life becomes utterly transformed. So it's always good to listen to this teaching as though it is a meditation, because in the moment of teaching, if I can see what is being said, that is the fructification, that is the blossoming of this this teaching. Pratasmarami, pratarsmarami. why would we meditate in the morning? At dawn. Actually, they considered Brahma Muhurta is the time before dawn, right? The 48 minutes or the two Muhurtas before dawn. Because, first of all, people are still sleeping. And when in India, especially, people get up. My experience is that everybody's up and about by dawn. And it's very difficult to meditate after that. It's actually very curiously difficult to meditate before dawn in places like Rishikesh, because some ashrams just blare their holy hymns at 4:30 in the morning to wake everybody up. That's another story. But it's considered an auspicious time to meditate. And if you sleep well, if you don't have sleep apnea, and you're not in the habit of eating heavy meals in the evening, you can wake up refreshed and light. And if your first thoughts are about what is the one thing that I want to hold with me throughout the day, pratar smarami hridi samspuradatma tatvam. Smarami, prataha, pratar. So the word is pratar. And then because of sandhi, it becomes prataha. And then when you chant it, it becomes pratas. So we say pratasmarami. At dawn, I meditate. I remember. Smra means to remember. Smarami means I remember, which means I contemplate. Why does it say remember? I bring to mind. Because nididhyasana, this meditation upon the meditator, the contemplation upon the contemplator, is an act of remembering what has been taught and what I have learned and what I know about me. Nididhyasana, or contemplation, is meant to remove the habitual error about myself. Listening to the teaching reveals the truth of myself. Shravanam, it's called. Mananam removes doubts and errors and vagueness regarding the nature of myself and what the Shastra says. Nididhyasana, or contemplation, removes habitual thinking that I am a limited individual. And so this meditation is a remembrance of what is taught and what I know. In fact, in some of the Upanishads, when a student approaches a teacher and asks him to teach, they will say, please remember, you know this, meaning you remember this, meaning please teach me. So the smaranam, this remembrance, means contemplation, which means bringing to mind what it is that I know about the nature of myself. And what is it that I contemplate upon? I contemplate upon atmatattvam, which is satchit sukham, which is paramahamsa gatim, which is turiyam. This is what I meditate upon. And where do I meditate upon it? He mentions that here. I meditate in my heart, hridi. Hrid means heart. Hridi means heart. In the heart. Now, sometimes hrid, the heart, hridayam, is translated as buddhi, as intellect. And both the words, English words, heart and intellect, have potential problems. Because if you say, if I contemplate in my intellect, it sounds very intellectual. It sounds very theoretical. When we say intellectual, we often say theoretical. This is not theoretical, because it's trying to point my mind to me. So buddhi, the antakarana, the inner instrument, we can take it, you know, traditionally it has memory and this I notion and the manas, the seat of emotions, and the buddhi, the seat of the intellect, of decisive thinking, of choice. That's how it's the antakarana, the inner instrument, is characterized. And sometimes hridayam is translated as buddhi. But like I said, there's that potential problem that in my intellect, it's recognized. Well, where else are you going to recognize, right? Where do you know things? Knowledge takes place in the buddhi, in the antakarana. There's no such thing as nasal knowledge, as Swamiji says. But it sounds a little abstract. It sounds theoretical. So when you say hrindi, in the heart, well, the heart is filled with all sorts of stuff, right? The heart can be filled with anguish and lust and compassion and quietude. But it's the core of our being, the heart of something. To get to the heart of something is to get to that, you know, the core of that artichoke. So it might be best to talk about this in terms of being the very reflective material of my experience, which is the heart of me. It's where the rubber meets the road. It's where consciousness meets the subtle stuff of thought and feeling. And so in that reflective material, void of agitating feelings or abstract thinking, that is the hridayam, that is the heart. And that is where I recognize myself to be, in the very core of my being. When you point to yourself, where do you point? The penultimate place, the second to the last place you point, is you as just a simple being. The final place you point to when you say I, you refer to Atma, Paramatma, limitless Brahman. But just before that, you can point to just the simple incarnated being. And it's this simple incarnated being that is at the heart of this jiva, this person. And it's in this reflective heart, a reflective mind, that I meditate, that I contemplate. Because contemplation is not an intellection. You use thoughts to direct attention based on intention, but it's not a thought process. It's a simple appreciation of my self-shining nature. And so that self-shining takes place in the heart. And appreciation is non-verbal. It's non-visual. It's the very presence which I am, which is present in every feeling, every thought. So in this heart, in this hridayam, this heart, I contemplate upon Atma Tattvam. This is the first line. Prata smarami hridi samspurad Atma Tattvam. Atma Tattvam. Tattvam means truth. We just finished Tattva Bodha, the knowledge of the truth or the knowledge of reality. Atma Tattvam is the truth of myself or the reality of myself or truth which is myself. It can be Atmanah Tattvam or Atma Eva Tattvam. Two different types of samasas, compounds. It's the truth of myself. When I say the truth of myself, it seems like truth is separate from myself, that somehow I contain the truth. That's a starting point. So the truth of me, whoever I happen to be taking myself to be at this time. But when you see the truth of yourself, as he'll say, as Sat Chit Sukham, Sat Chit Ananda, then the truth of myself is reality itself. So the Eva, the Atma Eva Tattvam, the truth, the reality of everything is me. That's the what I'm meditating upon. I'm meditating on the Satyam, and I'm appreciating that everything else is Mithya. So when I'm talking, I'm assuming we have this Tattva Bodha under our belt to some degree. You know, I can use some of this terminology. If some of this terminology is somewhat unfamiliar, don't worry, we'll be talking about all this too. But this Atma Tattvam is what I contemplate upon, the truth, which is synonymous with me. The Tattva, the that-ness. Tattvam. Don't confuse that with Tattvam Asi. That's a different Tattvam. Those are two different words. Tat is that, Tvam is you. This Tattva of the self is the ness of that. It's the very being of that. Tat is a pronoun, sarvanama. It stands for any word. That, this, that, this, that, this, that, this. What is the ness of that, of that, of that? When I mean ness, I mean what is essential to that? What is the very being of that, of that, of that? And when I point to anything, I say, that is, that is, that is, the mind is, the thoughts are, the feelings are, you know, in English we have is, am, are. You are, I am, it is. You are, I am, it is. That is just the verb to be. And the verb to be points out being. To be tries to point to being, which is synonymous with existence. So when you say that chair exists, you say that chair is, you're saying that chair exists. And that existence seems to be an attribute of that chair. But existence seems to be an attribute of the table and the attribute of this cloth. Existence seems to be an attribute of the thought and the feeling and this body. And when we pay attention, when we put our attention on existence, if we can discern what we mean when we say that chair exists, and we focus on that existence, that is-ness, that the chair seems to enjoy, I see that there's no discontinuity between the existence of the floor and the existence of the table and the existence of the room and the existence of the body and the existence of the thought and the existence of me. There is no discontinuity, just like there is no discontinuity in space. Space exists throughout all objects. Like, look at the objects around you right now in your room. Look at the objects, the table, the chair, the computer, the camera, etc., the light. They all exist in space. Now, look at the space. Pay attention to the space. If space can become predominant in your mind, then the objects which enjoy space, which rely on space, become sort of the background, right? Space always seems to be in the background. And the objects seem to be in the foreground. They're pushing themselves into my consciousness, into my mind. But look at space. If we see that everything three-dimensional enjoys a spatial component, there is no discontinuity of space. And that space is all pervasive. No object displaces space. One object displaces another object. But no object displaces space. It depends upon space. Similarly, to some degree, I can put in the foreground of my mind existence. Because I can point to everything, and everything seems to exist. But there's no discontinuity. There's no division in existence between when I say I am and that is, what is incidental, when I say the body is and the table is. What is incidental is the table and the body. What is fundamental is the isness. And that is the tattva. That is the reality of the Atma. That is the reality of the Atma. And that's what I bring to mind. That's what I contemplate. Pratar smarami hridi, in my heart, the Atma tattva, the truth which is myself, which is samspurat, which is shining in the heart. Well, if Atma, isn't it Sarvagata? Isn't it everywhere? Isn't Brahman everywhere? Isn't Brahman the truth of everything? You just said everything exists, so why do I contemplate it in the heart? Because that's where it's recognized. That's where I can see it. If I see it as a core of my being, then I can see it everywhere. It's also because just like a light, like the sunlight, is reflected off of opaque objects so I can see them, but the sun is reflected in the mirror so many times more brilliantly, much more true to its form. When I see a chair, I see the reflected light, sunlight off of that chair. If I hold up a mirror and see the reflection of the sun, I'm going to get blinded. Because of the reflective nature, the inherent reflective nature of that mirror versus a piece of wood that the chair is made out of. So too, my heart is like that mirror. My intellect is like that mirror, because in there is the reflection of pure consciousness. And so even though the Sat-Chit is all-pervasive, I recognize it as my very being, where it's manifest as consciousness. And then translates into me being a sentient being. Samspurat means twinkling, shining in the heart. that Atma Tattva, which I meditate upon, is shining in the heart. Now, I like twinkling, but twinkling implies a coming and going. You know, oh, there it is, though it isn't. You know, it seems to pulsate, twinkle. But it's not twinkling here. It is shining brightly. Atma Tattvam. Sat Chit Sukham. This Atma Tattva, this truth which is the self, is Sat Chit Ananda, which is Paramahamsa Gatim and Turiyam. Sat Chit Sukham means Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means existence, as we've been talking about. Chit is consciousness. And there's not two separate things. We don't have consciousness, which is aware of existence, and we don't have existence, which lends itself to consciousness. They're two words for the same thing. It's like looking at the top of the mountain from two different perspectives. You both see the peak. One person may call it Mount X, and someone may call it Mount Y, but it's still the same thing. It's just described from two different perspectives. It's actually described from the perspective of our interests. Because we take ourselves to be mortal. We take ourselves to be eventually passing out of existence. And the Shastra says, no, 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 no. You will never pass out of existence. Your body may pass out of existence. You are existence itself, Sat. But I may lose my consciousness, because the consciousness is just epiphenomena of this physiological, biochemical, brain synapses. No, you are pure consciousness. You are the consciousness that informs every piece of knowledge. This is satyam jnanam anantam, limitless. It's sat existence without the apparently limiting factor of the chair. Out the apparently limiting factor of the body, of the mind. Just pure sat. Pure existence. Pure consciousness. It's just consciousness, like the crystal in today's meditation. The crystal can apparently take on all the different colors of what is behind it. Here we have a little show and tell here. Now the crystal is black. Oh, now the crystal turns orange with some black lines in it. Oh, the crystal has turned light blue. Oh, look, it's orange again. Oh, it's dark blue. Oh, look, there's some red. The crystal is red. How many colors do I have here, right? Look how the crystal changes color. The poor crystal, it undergoes so many modifications. Oh, look, it's red. It must be angry. Oh, look, it's orange. It must be feeling like a renunciate. Oh, look, it's blue. It's feeling sad. Oh, look, it's green. It must be jealous. No, this crystal is shuddha, nitya shuddha. It is always, always just clear. And yet the upadhis, if you remember that term, an upadhi is that by its mere juxtaposition, its mere proximity, seems to lend its qualities to something else. The cloth, by its mere proximity, seems to lend the qualities of the colors to the inherently clear, clean, pure shuddha spatika, the clear, clean crystal. So too, the thoughts, our feelings, our self-conclusions seem to color consciousness, but there is no coloration of consciousness. I am always pure like that crystal. And these passing feelings, these passing thoughts are interesting. They're threatening if I take myself to be them, especially if they're the nasty feelings like anger or possessiveness or sadness. Those are things I don't want. Push, 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 push that away, push that away. No, 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 no. You know, but the thing is that consciousness illumines those ugly thoughts, quote unquote ugly thoughts. Consciousness illumines that desire to be different. Consciousness illumines the intention to push away. Consciousness illumines that pushing away. There's a whole cascade of thought. I notice a thought. I notice the nature of the thought. I make a judgment about that thought vis-a-vis my value system or my desire system. I don't want to have selfish thoughts. Then I make a conclusion based on that thought that I am that thought, and then therefore I am selfish, right? If a thought comes and says, I really want to kill that person. Oh, the next thought will be, oh, I'm a bad person because I want to kill that person. I don't want to kill that person. You've just stumbled. Because if the thought comes, I want to kill that person. Oh, I'm a bad person. Ah, look at that one. Oh, I'm not really a bad person. I'm not this thought. Ah, look at that one. Consciousness doesn't care what's happening in terms of the feelings or the thoughts. It's always just shining. It's always just illumining whatever comes. And the more I can rest in that sat-chit, rest in my being, which is the source of my happiness, and not define myself by the changing kaleidoscopic, colorful circus that is happening in my mind, in my heart, and in my relationships, the more that I can be free amidst all of that, the quieter the mind actually becomes. And the more I'm adopting a jnani's drishti, the vision of a jnani, of a wise one. Because a jnani doesn't identify with the functions of the mind. It's just there. It's just, I'm free enough to have emotions. A jnani says, I'm free enough to have emotions. I'm free enough to have silly thoughts. It's just like a circus. It's like, wow, look at that man on the high wire. Look at all those clowns coming out of that car. You can look at these horrible, horrible thoughts that you have as just more clowns coming out of that little Volkswagen. How do they stick all those clowns in that Volkswagen? Little beetle anyway. What a wonder. Ashcharyavat. So I'm contemplating on existence. I'm contemplating on chit, and I'm contemplating on sukham. Now the sukham, the sat-chit sukham is synonymous with sat-chit ananda, which is synonymous with satyam jnanam anantam. It is the limitlessness, which is the very nature of my being, from which I derive joy. There's no more pleasant place to be than with myself. And if you develop a contemplative mind, the mind naturally wants to just rest with me. Because everything I see as causing me happiness, I love. If my partner causes me happiness, I love them. If pizza causes me happiness, I say, I love pizza. If my puppy dog causes me to be happy, I say, I love my puppy dog. But the true beloved is really not your partner, is not your dog, and it's definitely not pizza. Your true beloved is yourself. Atmanastu kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati. Everything is beloved for the sake of the self. It sounds so vain. I'm the most delightful thing. But it's true. If you know yourself to be. And the thing is that everyone else in their hridayam, in their hrit, in their heart, is that same naturally joyful being. It's just that to fully appreciate that and live from that heart, from that vision of freedom, it takes intention and attention. And of course, this knowledge. So, chit sukham, sat chit sukham aham smarami pratar. In the morning, I meditate upon sat chit ananda, which is Paramahamsa gatim. Paramahamsa gatim is hamsa. Hamsa means goose. Parama means most excellent. So in the morning, I wake up and I meditate on this totally gnarly goose. Surprised, huh? Hamsa does mean a swan. It does mean a swan. And mythologically, there's this creature, a bird, which is called Hamsa, which is a viveki. It has the capacity to discriminate. The story goes is that this Hamsa has the capacity to stick its beak in water and milk mixture and just extract the milk and leave the water. So it's seen as a symbol, as a very poetic image of a viveki, of one who has viveka, of one who has the ability to discriminate between the real and the unreal. Nitya nitya vastu vivekaha, might sound familiar from Tattva Bodha, the discriminative wisdom or knowledge between what is nitya and what is anitya, what is meaningful and what is not meaningful, what is real and what is not real, what is timeless and what is time-bound, what is free from time and what is fleeting. And also it can be applied to dharma, the one who could discern dharma and adharma, dakshaha, who has the capacity. That's a meaning of the word daksha, is one who has the discriminative capacity. Here, the dhatu han has two different meanings. It means himsa gatyoho. It means either going or it means destroying. Paramahamsa means a wise one. And Paramahamsa is often a term given for a sannyasi, a renunciate, because one who finds simple freedom and joy in just being, recognizing Brahman as the nature of oneself and the truth of everything, whether one has orange robes or not, that is a true sannyasi. But the one who is a sannyasi, ajnanam hanti. Hamsa means ajnanam hanti. Hanti means he destroys, he kills, he utterly destroys ajnanam, ignorance. And so therefore he's ajnani, and he's unparalleled. He's unsurpassed. That's what parama means. Sundaram gachati means he goes towards beauty. That's another meaning of the word han, dhatu han. He goes towards beauty, which is ananda, which is sukham, which is the truth of himself. So this paramahamsa gatim. Paramahamsa gatim. Gati means a path, or it means a goal. It means I contemplate upon that thing which is reached by the sannyasis, which is reached by the wise one, which is reached by the jnani. How do I reach myself? Right? Gati comes from the dhatu gam, to go. So it's a place where one goes. But one can only come to oneself through an appreciation of what one is, the truth of oneself. So it's the thing achieved, but it's achieved through knowledge. And Swamiji says, even the Lord can't give you a head over your shoulders. A bald man goes into a barber and he says, take it all off. I want a bald head. He already has that. You know, how much does he have to pay for that? How many times does he have to go in to the barbershop, get his head all lathered up, the barber take the razor and shave it all off and says, okay, now you're bald, you're fine. Ah, finally, I've always wanted to be bald. The next day he comes in and says, please, I want it all off. That barber is a scoundrel who keeps shaving the bald man's head. This world is a scoundrel because it keeps promising to give us happiness when really we are already what it is we seek to be. I am the beloved, which I love and miss dearly. That's why we're constantly seeking. We miss it dearly, right? And if we're Paramahamsa, then we've attained it. It's a praptasya praptihi. It's a appreciation of what I already have. It's an attainment of the already attained. That is the nature of this gati, this place where jnanis reside. Jnanis go to retire in Satchidananda. So these are the first line of the first verse. So what we can do is pick up next week and finish this verse and then continue on to the next one. But let's just chant this together one more time. Let's chant it two times together. And if you want, you can just listen the first time and then chant along the second time. But remember, the words are prataha, in the morning, smarami, I contemplate upon atmatattvam, the truth which is myself, samspurat, which is shining, hridi, in the heart. And that atmatattvam is satchit sukham, is limitless existence, consciousness, and joy, which is the paramahamsa gatim, which is the gati, which is the abode, which is the attainment of the paramahamsa, of the unsurpassed jnani, wise one. And we'll talk about turiyam next time, because turiyam goes with swapna jagara sushuptam, avaiti nityam, tad brahma nishkalamaham nacha bhuta sangha. I'll chant it once, and you can chant it with me, or you can chant it along the second time. Om pratasmarami hridi samspuradatma tattvam satchit sukham paramaham sagatin turiyam yat swapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam tad brahma nishkalamahanna cha bhuta sanghaha pratar smarami hridi samspuradatma tattvam sachit sukham paramaham sagatin turiyam yat swapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam tad brahma nishkalamahanna cha bhuta sanghaha Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam chobarahitah brahmanah santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. We have a question here. Where are you picking up the word meditate if Parami is memory? Smri Dhatu, the verbal root smri means to remember. Smarami means I remember, which in this context means I contemplate upon, I meditate upon. So it's the dinganta, it's the conjugated verb smarami, I remember, meaning I contemplate upon.
I didn't realize how quickly the time had gone, actually.
Blood flubbing, yeah.